get in it as soon as the round would impact, then we'd go back and continue our survey. And so that particular fire was not to you know, effective from the enemy standpoint. It yet bothered people, but we were all in holes most of the time. The we stayed in holes or in bunkers underneath the ground, and consequently it did little other than harass people, which, you know, it was, that's what we called it, harassing fires. When we would get a heavy concentration of artillery fire, it was very demoralizing. I'd say that times when they really hit us hard with artillery, the morale was probably as low as it ever got. And these are the only times that I know that morale got real low. And I'm talking about the people around me, because we were not able to do anything about it. The day, probably the blackest day in my life was the day that we received that 1,300 rounds of incoming. Because, you know, it was just a continuous rounds coming in the compound all day long, just one right after the other, you know. And it, you know, you couldn't walk outside because you knew that stuff was coming in all day. And we also took some casualties that day, and of course that's demoralizing. And but, you know, I even had thoughts of, you know, will I live through this day? And at times, you know, I didn't really care. It was just a very black day, and very. When you can't do anything, when you can't fire back. Now, we did have to fire missions during this because things came up, and our artillery crews got out in that and fired missions, and they took casualties during this time. And we had. We feel certain the NVA was using homing devices, radio communication device, to locate the operation centers on the base, because at times like this, most of the rounds centered around, like, the FDC, where we had lots of communication gear. And there are ways to use homing devices to find exactly spot these places, and we feel they were doing this because they certainly kept the rounds right near us. And like I say, the artillery battery, which was Alpha battery just behind us, took a lot of casualties that day, and because we were firing missions during this. And our company office, our battery office, which was hit that day, and our first sergeant was killed. And we took an awful lot of fire in our immediate area, and we suffered more casualties that day than any other day that I know of, for my unit, not the compound as a whole, because the infantry units took a lot of casualties at different times. But not so much during the incoming, because they too had holes to get in. And although I know of instances where they did take casualties during artillery, incoming artillery, the artillery was centered in the incoming artillery was centered in the operational area of the base, of the airstrip, the 26 Marines Operations Center, and the Artillery Operations Center. But it, I don't know, you know, it became something you learned to live with, the incoming artillery fire. I don't, amazing, a thing that really amused me, when the Army finally came in up there, they obviously were not used to incoming artillery fire, and they landed, and shortly after they landed, we received a lot of incoming, and we had established radio nets in the Fire Direction Center to accompany, to accommodate the Army units in the area. And on all of the nets, the Army came up and yelled, "Fire, counter fire!" And I had never even heard that term. Of course, I know what counterfire is, counter-artillery fire, but we never fired back because it was useless. We couldn't reach where these rounds were coming from. And again, I say that was the most frustrating thing about all of the incoming artillery that we had. You know, we occasionally, from this COROC position, if we had an aerial observer up in the air, he could see the puffs of smoke from where this stuff was fired, but we were still nothing we could do about it because it was outside our range. And obviously, the air, this is one place that the air support couldn't help us because they were in thick undergrowth and places of this nature, and they just did not have a good target. The air didn't have a good target to attack.
How about the casualties from incoming? As far as the artillery is concerned, how do you man a gun when you lose a gunner or a loader or whatever?
Well, of course, I wasn't actually in the firing batteries, but they take the people that are there and use them. It doesn't make any difference. Now, of course, you have to have a crew chief. You have to have a gun crew chief. And but whoever the senior man in the pit is, he's that. And you continue to fire. And this Alpha battery that I mentioned earlier, they took the worst beating that I'm aware of. They lost their first sergeant, they lost their gunnery sergeant, they lost their platoon sergeants, and they were just, the other people that were there just took their positions. Of course, they brought in a new first sergeant and a new gunnery sergeant, but the crew chiefs and such as this, I mean, you have in a organization chart, you have six or seven people on a gun crew, and they were operating most of the time with three or four people on a gun. You'd have somebody to handle the sight, the traversing mechanism, and somebody to load the thing. And, they were operating on a very skeleton crew, and a lot of times they couldn't fire all their guns. In fact, we had one gun that took a direct hit and was put out of commission. They had to airlift it out. And I think we did get a replacement for it, but on many occasions we could not fire all six guns in the battery because of the shortage of people. Replacements, we'd get some replacements, and they'd just train them as best they could. And speaking of replacements, if I could, you know, if there's anybody I ever felt sorry for, it was a replacement coming in there, because these were the people that, you know, had not been committed to combat, and to be dropped in a place like that. We had a lot of casualties among replacements because they didn't know what to do, and, you know, they were lost. And,
could you give some examples? Well, one of our other people has said the same.
Well, I actually didn't get any, so I can't say exactly how they felt. It's just, you know, the way I feel, the way my empathy says they must have felt, you know. That, of course, back at Phu Bai, a lot of them flew up with me, and they were just scared green kids. They had never been in combat, and to be dropped in a place that was, you know, under attack constantly, either by artillery fire or probes by the enemy, by the NVA. It had to be just the scariest time in a person's life. We did get some replacements. One particular thing was another day that we received real heavy incoming, and we got in 13 replacements, and they came in, and we started getting an artillery attack, and they were put in a bunker which was above ground, and a very undesirable place to be. And this bunker took a direct hit, and all 13 of those people were medevaced, either killed or medevaced out of there that same day. Never knew what hit them. You know, just come in one day and leave that same day, either in a bag or medevac. It was like we, you know, one of the, in that book, I was, the Battle of Quezon, there's a, it does not list one of our commanding officer, our executive officer, that Major Campbell, who was our executive officer, was actually relieved of duties. He had a replacement come in, and the day that that major came in, I think his name was Green, I'm not sure, because he was only there for half a day. He walked out of his tent in the evening, or out of his bunker in the evening, before dark, and a rocket round had landed right in front of him, and it didn't kill him, but he was medevaced that same day. And you know, you just walk into such the ones of us that were there, you know, we're used to this stuff, but somebody just coming in, a replacement coming in to a situation like that now, just has to be the most horrible thing on earth. You know, if you were there for the entire thing, you know, I went up there, the situation built up, you know, I watched the situation build up, and it didn't seem to be any particular big deal. But to be thrown into something like that with this cold had to be very terrifying.
This is a good point, Ben. Is this not the situation that many newsmen found themselves thrown in cold?
Right. Now, like I say, I didn't see any particular newsman, but it would be the same thing. You know, just to come up there and come in, and all they could see is what people told them and showed them. They wouldn't have any idea exactly what's going on. And I never had the occasion to meet a newsman up there, and I did see some from a distance. They would say those are newsmen because they were dressed as we were. They were in the same uniforms we were in. And they may have had some equipment, camera equipment and what have you, but I never actually met any of them.
What about the bunkers? You had a story about being down in a bunker and getting a little scared, hitting your head.
You bet.
Could you describe what it was to be inside a bunker and the feel of, you know, when the incoming is there and so on? Were they adequate? That sort of thing.
I think I'll go way back. You know, when we first got there, we decided to build a bunker, naturally. I mean, you don't take a fire direction center and just put it in a tent. I mean, when you're expecting to be in a combat situation. So we started to build a bunker, and we were building it. The fire direction people were building it, and we had no engineer experience or how to build bunkers or what have you. We were building a big monster, and it was during, we started it before it started raining real hard, but we had not completed it, and it started raining, and we did not have a top on it or anything of that nature, and we were working in a couple of feet of water most of the time, and then one night we had a pretty serious rain, and one of our walls caved in on us on the bunker, and just knocked us out of that. So they decided to get the engineers to build us a bunker, and we operated out of a tent for a couple of weeks while the engineers came in and dug a hole. And the first bunker we had was built with native timber. They went out into the Quezon village and brought back timbers, and which we later found out were infested with termites. And they dipped these in creosote, so, you know, to prevent the termites from doing anything, but it didn't work because the termites stayed with it and weakened the structure considerably. And these were big 12-inch logs, which should have been sufficient to withstand quite a bit of incoming fire. Of course, our roof on it was not very substantial, and we could not have taken a direct hit in that bunker. Fortunately, we didn't. The timbers, let's see, this bunker was approximately 30 feet by 20 feet in width and length. And The termites, I think, were our big problem because, you know, all the time up until we were taken under attack, we noticed that we had the termite dust coming out of the logs, and they were, our firing charts were situated underneath logs, and every morning we'd have to clean off firing charts, or quite frequently during the day we'd have to clean off firing charts, and it was just little like sawdust, which the termites had eaten through the logs. And so when we came under fire, every time a round would land near the FDC, we could see the logs splitting. And it became a very precarious situation because we knew if we ever took a real close hit, that it, you know, we didn't know what would happen. And but one log, and the fire direction officer and myself lived in the bunker, and the troops, all of the watch people lived in bunkers near the FDC, and they've just rotated in and out. But the fire direction officer and myself lived in the bunker and operated the FDC at all times. One of us was in there, and in the actual FDC operation, and we had a little room enclosed off to the back. And but you know, spending 24 hours a day in this thing, and every time we had these rounds come around, well, when I came back off R&R, there was a split of approximately.
Back in business?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're talking about the coming back off R&R and the splits getting larger and larger?
Right, and okay, the engineers and the CBs, after we were attacked, they brought the engineers and CBs with proper bunker building materials up there for the major installations, the operations center, the fire direction center, places like this, and they went up at the other end of the base and built us a 20 by 40 foot bunker for the fire direction center, and they gave us a few more, a little more room for people to actually live in there. The watch sergeants moved in there in addition, and a few of the officers moved in there. So, you know, to provide maximum protection for essential people. And they built this super bunker. They used 6x6s and 10x10s. And you know, they knew how to build it. They built it right, and they put four feet of dirt, crushed rock on top of the fire direction center, on top of the timbers, and this bunker could withstand direct hits. And we did take at least one direct hit on that bunker. You know, speaking of that direct hit, you know, we had. I mentioned in my letter to you about the crater analysis, and I told you I knew particularly where all these rounds were coming from, because initially when we started taking the artillery fire, I used to go out and do these crater analyses. I was the only one in the compound at this time that knew how to take a crater analysis and determine which direction the round was coming from. And but on this night when we took the direct hit, this Major Houchin was the fire direction officer at the time, and I was in the back shaving, and the round landed. And when a round lands, when you take a direct hit and you're in a bunker, it doesn't, you don't hear the explosion so much as the ring. You get a ringing in your ears on a very close hit or direct hit. And I didn't even hear the explosion, but I was back there shaving, and Major Houchin says, Gunny Martin, I want you to go out and make a crater analysis. And he said, I don't think you'll have far to go. And I didn't look in the FDC, but it had split. One of the 10x10 timbers above the operations area. I didn't notice that until I come back in, but I went up, and it had been a direct hit immediately over the operation area, and it was a 152 millimeter howitzer gun. The NVA had a howitzer gun, 152 millimeter fuse delay. So that proved to me that that bunker could withstand anything. Now, and when we moved, a day or so after we moved out of the old bunker, that bunker did take it, not a direct hit, but a near direct hit, and caved the entire thing in. And so we were very fortunate to have gotten out of that in time, because we had anywhere from 10 to 20 people in there working at all times, and with communications personnel and the fire direction personnel.
Bill, what about a lot of criticism in the news that the Marines weren't properly dug in, weren't properly protected and so on? Was that valid?
Well, you know, I would say it's probably so. We probably were not dug in properly initially. It's very tough to make people know that they need to dig in until the occasion arises where you have to. And you know, when we, I know in the case of my own troops, the ones that worked for me, I had 35 people working for me when this thing started, and we had sandbag tents at that particular time. We had tents above the ground, and we had 4 feet of sandbags double stacked up the sides, and this is not adequate protection, because now we ended up of course, one of the things is we didn't have the equipment to handle something like this. We didn't have bulldozers to excavate. Now when we got attacked, they brought in bulldozers. I know we may have had them in the compound, but anyway, they came and dug holes out, and then we had to go in and build our own bunkers. They would put up a frame for personnel, I'm talking about. They would excavate a hole and put up a frame, and then we'd have to do the work, put the sandbags up and everything. We used ammo boxes and sandbags to build bunkers, but this was after we were attacked. I wouldn't know where the... Of course, I don't know whether anyone knew that we were going to be attacked to the degree that we were attacked. And our protection was adequate up until the time that we got put under siege. But once we became under siege and started taking a lot of incoming artillery and rocket fire, no, it wasn't enough protection. And we had to... one instance... I had my watch sergeants that worked for me. They never did end up in a bunker. They had a tent sandbag, and that tent never took a hit during the entire siege. And they slept in it every night. I'll say one of them at least didn't sleep very sound when he was in there, but he did sleep there.
Did they stay in the tent? It seems
I don't know. I never did figure that out, because we did build sufficient bunkers for them to move into. Well, they felt as safe, I think, as they would have in a bunker, because they had, you know, this matting, this airstrip matting. We had quite a bit of that around, and they had that actually over their sleeping areas. So that offered as much protection, I guess, as just about. It would have taken a direct hit to have done anything. And most bunkers there, personnel bunkers and the like, could not have withstood a direct hit. It takes a pretty stout fortification to withstand a direct hit. So, I don't know. We had lots of people up there that actually slept in places less secure than I would have wanted to sleep in. And it didn't seem to bother them. I don't know. We all have different, you know, different things goes through our minds in a combat situation.
You mentioned the night Long Bay fell, and I wonder if you could describe that, the, you know, existence of tanks, and you could hear what was going on through the FTC and so on.
Right.
Could you describe the night that Long Bay fell?
Right. You know, this is another, you know, memorable night in my life. You know, Long Bay was Americans and Montagnards and Vietnamese down there, and they were off all by themselves, just a small detachment of men. And, you know, we thought about them a lot because that was not a very good place to be. I mean, at least we had 4,000 or 5,000 people at our compound and could put up a pretty good fight, but the small detachment like Long Bay could not withstand anything of any heavy nature in an attack form. And of course, I think it was, you know, from the time that we went under siege, which was around the 19th of January, I believe, until the night of the 7th of February, if I'm not mistaken, it was the 7th of February. And when they came under attack, you know, we knew they were in for it because it was just not a good place to be. You know, they were right at 7 miles from us, and our range on the 105 howitzer is 7 miles, which meant we were right on our maximum range line from one gun position, and the other two gun positions we had a little better. But anywhere on the end of the maximum range line of an artillery weapon, you don't have as good accuracy, and we just didn't have enough support to drive the defenders away. But when they came under attack, especially when we heard the sound that the tanks were in the area, we heard that you know, they came up on the radio and said they were being attacked by tanks. And you know, here again, this is a thing that was hard to conceive because, you know, I had never heard of tanks being employed in Vietnam, and so just the thought of a tank was very demoralizing to me. And we fired, you know, we started firing for them, and we fired all night long. Of course, we lost contact. We had radio communications in our FDC with the Long Bay people, and they didn't have much to say as time went on, but they would, one particular time while they were under this tank attack and everything, obviously, we were firing Fuse VT right over their position. Fuse VT is an air burst that bursts 20 meters off the ground. And evidently, while we were firing this, maybe the attack broke up somewhat because the people in their operations center came up on the air and said, "We don't know what you're doing, but it must be working," because it evidently was taking some of the pressure off of them. But this was after they had all sealed themselves in the command bunker, and then we fired this Fuse VT over their position. When they were all in the bunker, they came up on the air and told that all of them that were alive were in the bunker and to fire protective fire. So we fired the Fuse VT right on their position. And then this was an early morning. And at one particular time, this radio operator came up and said, "There's a tank moving towards our position." And then we lost radio contact with them. And so we just continued to fire what support we could give them on the remainder of the night until we had an AO went up first thing the next morning, first light the next morning, and came and reported it. You know, no activity in the area, so we ceased firing. And, when we heard the tank bit, of course we didn't. You know, we're not prepared to fight tanks as such. You know, but right shortly thereafter, You know, every man that came into a caisson replacement was carrying a rocket launcher over his shoulder because they were given to get us plenty of anti-tank weapons in the area in case we did have a tank attack. Of course, they did pull the tanks out of there. We did have the occasion either the next day or day after one of the AOs spotted a tank down near the river just past Long Bay, and we did fire a precision destruction mission on the tank, which we had to abort after about 25 rounds because we just flat couldn't hit him. Here again, we were on our getting close to our maximum range line, and the dispersion of the projectile was too great to actually hold a precision destruction mission on the tank. And it was also partially concealed behind a sand embankment, and we just couldn't get a good shot at it.
How about the sensors that were used? This is an important part of...
well, I think...